This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The words sex trafficking have a way of making people tune out. Why? Because no one thinks it's their problem. It could be because the first time America heard about sex trafficking, it was about people being victimized on their way to the United States from other countries. Women who are being blackmailed or forced to pay off the smugglers who brought them here. It's no less heinous, but maybe that's why when I recently told an acquaintance that we were working on this show, he looked at me and said, well, sex trafficking's not a big deal here, is it? Well, maybe that old perception of it being somewhere else and someone else never really went away. But the reality is girls, women, and boys as young as 6 years old are being trafficked, which is a sanitized way to say sold for sex by pimps unwillingly every day in Naples, in Fort Myers, in Port Charlotte, in Sarasota, Cape Coral, Inglewood, Clewiston, LaBelle, Lehigh. No neighborhood is immune. And what makes it even harder to pinpoint and prosecute is that many of the victims are so young, so desperate, so brainwashed, or so fearful that they barely understand what's happening to them. So they blend into society like nothing's wrong, but they know something's wrong. They just have no idea how to escape and begin to piece their life back together. WGCU's Jessica Mazaros has been working on this story for a few weeks, and while talking, we decided that we should dedicate a full hour to this subject. She joins me now in the studio. Jessica, thanks for your work on this.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We're talking about the alarming rise in the sexual slavery issue in Southwest Florida and how the scourge of human trafficking has spread across all socioeconomic levels. You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. So, Jessica, what is the current situation with human trafficking in Southwest Florida?
Currently, Southwest Florida is number one in the state of Florida for human trafficking, and Florida is third in the country. So it's clearly a big issue. And this is just with people that have reported these things. I mean, there's a lot out there that we still don't know.
Well, like we mentioned, it's hard to even tell who's being trafficked, and even the people being trafficked may not really realize that's what's happening to them.
Yeah.
So reported versus what's actually happening is almost impossible to figure.
I mean, the numbers now are pretty outstanding, and so to find out what's not being reported may just, you know, it's just kind of overwhelming to think about.
Are the numbers going up, or are they going up exponentially, or?
So right now, the items for trafficking, number one used to be drugs, number two used to be weapons, and number three used to be humans. Now it's drugs, humans, weapons, and it's projected to be number one very soon. So it is increasing, and it's in our backyard, and it's mostly primarily minor females. It does happen to boys, but it does tend to be minor women.
Well, when you give that ranking and they say that human trafficking may possibly overtake drug trafficking, and here we are in the middle of an opioid epidemic.
Right.
So the fact that human trafficking could increase beyond what drugs are being sold illegally, that's pretty shocking.
It is pretty shocking because you always have to go once you sell a drug or a weapon, you need more. You've sold it. You've gotten your profit off that. You can sell a person an infinite amount of times if you keep them locked up somewhere. So you don't have to go and have a middleman for anything. You just own your property and you use it until you get caught, I guess.
In Southwest Florida, as small as it is, I mean, it's not the most populous part of the state. We're still number one in the state.
Yeah, it fluctuates between one and two right now. So right now we are number one. Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it's an individual and human story beyond those statistics. And I remember when we first started talking about putting the story together, we wanted to tell the story of someone who has gone through the horror of being sold for sex against their will. And in the past, we've only been able to find people who would talk anonymously. But this time it was different.
Yeah, I was able to speak with Misty Kinzel of Lee County. She published a book in 2016 called From the Streets to the Cross. She candidly tells all the details of her drug addiction and trafficking experiences from about 20 years ago in Lee County. She's now a mother of three and owns her own business out of Cape Coral called Misty Sunshine Cleaning, where she has about a dozen employees. She says God helped her many times throughout her life, and she tells her story openly to serve him and to help others who may be in a similar situation.
How old do you think you were when you, like, grew up? Because from talking with you, it feels like you grew up a lot younger than most people.
Probably around 7 years old.
And why is that?
I was molested by my sister's husband, my girlfriend's father, and my brother.
And how did you deal with that? I mean, that's such a young age. How do you move on from that or even understand what's going on?
I didn't know it was bad. They didn't beat me, rape me. It was more or less, you're beautiful. This is what we're supposed to do. And if you tell anybody, we can all get in trouble. I dealt with it with started smoking cigarettes, started smoking weed, started drinking, running away.
Around what age did you start smoking and drinking and running away?
I think I took my first puff off a cigarette and off weed around 8 years old. And I started drinking probably around 12 or 13.
And who facilitated these things for you? Because at that young age, I imagine it might be hard to come by.
Well, I caught my sister in the bathroom when she was smoking cigarettes. So, you know, so I went and tell mom, you know, she's pretty much like, well, you got to just try it. And then when I tried it, it was, you know, now you can't do anything. My mom used to leave big, long cigarette butts in the ashtray. So I would take her cigarette butts and smoke them. As for the weed, when I ran away, there was a guy down the road that I would get high at his house. And as for alcohol, my mother used to have some up in her cupboard. And I would learn to drink that and then add water to it when I was done.
And so when you would run away, so you mentioned that you would meet this guy up the street, and so at what point did you ever just not come home again?
No, I always came home. I would be gone for a couple days, but there was a guy that lived down at the end of our dead end street, and there was woods down there that I just loved. You know, I could go there, and that's where I could get my peace. And you know, when he was home, I would go over there sometimes just to get, you know, just to talk and drink a couple beers and smoke a little weed.
And what was this place like where you got your peace? Can you describe what you felt when you were there?
Just like nothing mattered. Like it was just like I was just at peace. Nobody was trying to yell at me. Nobody was bothering me. Nobody was touching me. You know, it was just a wooded area at the end of the road with a big rock in the middle. And that's where I would sit at and just think.
And then so fast forward a couple years, what was your teenagers like?
I was still being molested. I was molested until I was 15, although my sister's husband stopped touching me from the age of 13 because I had taken sex ed in school. And I realized then that, oh, my God, this is what's been going on, because my mother really never talked about sex. So we, you know, I didn't really know exactly what I was doing. I just knew I was doing it. So I had told him, you know, that this is it. You know, you're not touching me no more. And then I ended up running away because he was threatening me a lot. And so I ended up running away, and my mom put me in a group home. And when she put me in the group home, on my way out of the group home, she told me that she was going to put me at my sister's house, that I was no longer going to live with her and my father, that I was going to live with my sister. So she put me exactly where I did not want to go.
At 15?
At 15.
And prior to telling him no, had you told anybody that this was going on?
Maybe a couple girlfriends of mine. But her father was touching her, and that's the father that touched me too. So to us, it was kind of, that's what we did. That's what was, it was natural, you know.
And then what happened when you lived with your sister?
Well, let me fix that. I was actually 14 when he put me there. She put me there, but I turned 15 like right afterwards. And on my 15th birthday, he bought us a bottle of Jack Daniels or rum and coke. It was something. And got me and my sister both drunk. And she passed out and I passed out. And I woke up the next morning with him on top of me. And then my sister walked in as I'm waking up and just called me everything in the book. And he admitted that it was his fault that time. But he never admitted that he touched me before.
And what was your relationship like with your sister after that?
We didn't have one. She was my everything. But he tore everything away. He took everything from me, my mom, my brother, my sister, you know. So she was my everything.
And then where did you go after that?
I ended up getting married. I moved in.
At 16, right?
I got married at 16. I went back home, and it was just not good. And then I ended up marrying the guy across the street. And I was with him until I was 19. But, you know, I didn't really marry him. I loved him, but I didn't love him. It wasn't the kind of love to get married for.
What was the reason for you to get married at 16?
Pretty much to get out of the house, you know, to break free.
What happened with that marriage?
Well, I got pregnant at 17, had my first son at 18, and me and my first husband decided I should become a stripper. As soon as I became a stripper, I was started getting introduced to cocaine. And then I did it for about 6 months. I didn't really like cocaine. And then I met the guy in a club, and he he promised the world to me. So I ended up going and divorcing my first husband. And me and the guy got in a house together, and I didn't realize that he smoked crack. And he introduced me to crack cocaine.
And how old was this person?
He was probably 3 years older than me, too.
Okay. And you got divorced at 19, you said?
I got divorced at 19.
And did you move your child in with this person also? Or
I did. Yeah, it was the three of us.
And what was that relationship like?
Well, at first it was good, you know. But then when the drugs started coming, which he tricked me on that, you know, he said it was hash. And try it, you know. So I tried it, and that was all it took. I ended up getting addicted. It was because it was crack.
For those who may not know, like, what happens when, for you, at least, when you become addicted to crack, what was it? How did your life change?
It was a whirlwind. I lost everything I had. All I wanted was to smoke crack. I just wanted another hit. No matter how much I loved my son, I could not get away from that drug. It took control over me, and I'm a very self-willed person. But it took away, like, the pain of the past. It took away – it just made me feel better about myself there for a minute, you know. But when the high started going down, you just had to have more. Like, you know, you needed that high again. And so even though as much as I loved my son, I did what was best for him because I seen myself going downhill. And I gave him to his aunt. So he did not have to live the life that I was going down, you know. I thought – letting him go to his aunt, I would stop. You know, I would be able to go get help and everything. But instead, it actually made it worse.
And how old was your son when you gave him to his aunt?
I want to say around two and a half.
And what was that like for you to have to give him up because of, you know, basically drugs and those kind of decisions?
It was very hard. And it was actually the worst mistake I ever made in my life. And yeah, it was hard.
And what happened after that? So now you said it made it worse.
Well, the guy that I was dating ended up going to jail. So I ended up going to the crack houses he was going to buy dope. And I was introduced to a girl there that told me that there was an easier way of making money than stripping. And she taught me how to become a prostitute. I was a prostitute for almost 7 years on Palm Beach Boulevard.
At what point did this did the prostitution, as we talked about earlier, at what point did this become a human trafficking situation?
Well, there was actually two different occasions. There was one where it was at the beginning of the being on the streets. It was the beginning. There was one time I met a guy at a crack house, and you know, he seemed really nice. He was there to buy dope, but but he was also a dealer, but he also smoked. So I went home with him and everything. When I got to his house, you know, he locked the door and deadbolted it and then raped me. And then a lady came in, and I was obviously his wife. And she, you know, took me to the shower, and then they put me in another room, and they would take me, they would feed me dope, you know, here and there. They would give me food if I was hungry. They weren't really mean to me. You know, they you know, after that point, it was, you know, they would take me places around the corner to his family member's house, and there would be many men there, and they would take turns on me. And then I would get, like, just a little piece of dope every once in a while, and they would get everything. So they take me back to their house or whatever, and then this guy wanted me to – he wanted to trick with me. But he didn't want to do it either one of the houses, so two drug dealers were in the front seat, and the trafficker was in the back seat. And the trafficker had a gun to me the whole time. And when we got to the guy's house, the guy was no longer there. So the drug dealers were a little mad because the guy owed him money for drugs and, you know, because he would smoke dope too.
And this was the guy with the wife that you were living with?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So on our way back to where they live, the drug dealers and the guy are arguing the whole time. And the gun is no longer pointed on me. So I'm thinking, you know, oh, my gosh, you know, whatever, you know. It was a scary situation because they were really fighting. And I looked over at the door, and the door was unlocked. And I seen these headlights coming towards the other car because, you know, it had just gotten dark. And I heard this voice inside my head. It said, "Misty, jump." So I went to reach for that door handle, and I did. As soon as that car got close enough, I jumped out in front of it, and I just took off running. Both cars stopped, and, you know, after that, I don't know what happened, but I took off running as fast as I could. And then there was another time when I met this lady in jail, and she was promised me the world. You know, you don't have to go back on the streets. You know, I can help you change your life and get your life clean. So as soon as we get to her house, well, her and her husband picked me up from jail when it was time for me to get out. When we got to her house, she had her walk-in closet in her bedroom was my bedroom. And guys would come in there, and that's where I'd have to service them. And they would get the money, and I would get just a piece of dope. And I was like, this is not what we agreed on, you know. I was not allowed to eat unless they were make food. You know, it was the only time. I was never allowed outside. And there was this one guy that he really liked me, and he would come by, and I guess he pretty much paid a lot of money. He asked me one day, he's like, you know, why are you here? Because she would sit in the bed, in her bed, while we were in the closet. So we had to watch what you say. But we got it out enough to where we were able to talk about how he was going to save me. And he made them an offer to meet. He worked at the incinerator when it was first started opening. And he made a deal with them to take me over to his job late at night when they get off, where it's pitch black, big, you know, parking lot, and there's no lights out there. So he told me that when they get out to give him, when he to go get the money for me to get out, take off running, and then meet him down the long driveway, you know, to where they went and find me. Do not get in his van, because they're, of course, going to look through his van shirt first to see if I'm there. So they got out, and the husband looked at me and said, don't try anything funny. And he had a gun. And I was thinking, I'm like, okay, you know, here we go with this again. So this was actually years later than the first one.
And this is the husband of the woman who you were in her closet?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. So they got out and to go meet the guy. And the guy, you know, I guess gave him money or whatever. And I took off running. I just ran out the truck as fast as I could. And I'm running down the dirt path of the parking lot. And he did exactly what they said they would. They looked through his vehicle. You know, they were walking around with flashlights and, you know, they were just trying to find me. And then eventually I see him pulling up and he picks me up and we take off. And then he survived, you know, saved me from that situation. And then I went back onto the streets.
And so going back to his question, the man who saved you, why were you there? What and also what were you thinking while you were in this closet? I mean, because she promised you like, hey, you know, this will be great. Right. Was it great? Like, what was your reaction when you were in there?
No, the whole deal was not for me to go and get back on drugs. You know, I was trying to get off of drugs. And the reason I was there, you know, is because she promised me, you know, she'll be able to help me get a job, take care of me and give me a place to stay until I did. But that's not really what happened when I got out of jail. It was back to prostitution and smoking crack.
So she heard your story in jail and then took advantage of that basically and
yes.
Did the same exact thing to you again?
Yes.
She knew that you were vulnerable to that?
Yes. They also smoke drugs, too. They smoke crack, too.
And what was your relationship like with this man who saved you after that?
We were friends for a little while, and then kind of like with any other trick, kind of like fade off. You know, you forget where they live, so you can't go by and say hi and thank them again. You know, if I could, I would go back and say thank you to this guy. But you're on so many – you're just so high that – you just kind of forget and fade off.
So those were the two instances of human trafficking,
yes,
that you mentioned?
Yes.
And so then after this man saved you and you said you went back to the streets, at what point, because you're a successful businesswoman, how did you get there from that situation to where you are now?
Oh, well, like I said, I was out there for almost 7 years. And, you know, I've been through so many things out there while I was out there on the streets, not only just human trafficking. You know, I've been raped multiple times. I've been beaten. I've been burnt. I was dragged up a highway with a guy going about 40 miles an hour till my T-shirt fell off. And I lived with serial killers. I was held hostage. I've been in jail almost, I think, 15 times. 13 were felonies. And, you know, every time I went to jail, I would find God more. Even when I was on the streets, if I was in a motel room, I'd pick up the Bible and start reading. Although I'm smoking crack, I would still read my Bible. Like, deep inside of me, I still knew that there was a God somewhere, and there had to be something greater than what I was doing. So I went to jail one last time, and well, not one last time, a second last before the last. And you know, I just had that desire that I really wanted to get off drugs. So as a prostitute and you done burn all your bridges, when I got out of jail, I had nowhere else to go but back on the streets. So I was started walking down the street about midnight one night, and I was hitting my crack pipe, and I said, Lord, please just let me get pregnant. I swear I'll never touch crack again. And at that moment, I didn't know he was going to answer my prayers. I just threw it out there like, hopefully this works. But I believed it. And a couple weeks or a couple months, I don't know, because I was so high, I realized I was pregnant. And then that's when I realized there really is a God. Like, Jesus is real, you know? I mean, because I had been taken off with so many men's money, and because my nickname was Gangster. I was, you know.
Can you explain what that is?
If a gentleman picked me up and they were married, or if they started talking about a woman right off the bat, I would take off with their money. So it wasn't, it was called gank. I was ganking them. So my nickname was Gangster. And that was my whole nickname the whole time I was on the streets. So, I knew who the guy husband, I mean, who got me pregnant, you know, when I found I was pregnant, because it was my drug dealer. He was the only one that I wasn't ganking at the time. And so what I did is I went and called my probation officer, and I told him I was pregnant, and I told him, asked him to please, you know, violate my probation. He said he can't just violate my probation. You actually have to do something. So I went and robbed a Guatemala for $3,000, and I came back to the house I was at, and I called him again. I said, okay, I just robbed somebody for money. He's like, Missy, that's not how it works. You have to get caught. So I sat there. I gave him my address. I said, listen, this is where I'm going to be at. I'm not leaving. I'm pregnant, and I'm getting high. Please come and get me. And a couple hours later, it had to be Jesus, because the police started knocking on my door. And I had robbed many of people, you know, so it had to be nobody but Jesus. And so I went to jail. I was in jail for a month, and I went in front of a judge, and it's the same judge I've been in front of many times. And the judge was getting ready to sentence me to 5 years in prison. And I got ready to stand up to talk for myself. And my prop defender kept trying to pull me down, and I'm like, no. And I said, Your Honor, and I said, you know, I've been in front of you many times. You never asked me, you know, if I need a rehab, you know, what's my problem? You know, what's going on in my life? I said, you've always given me 1 year's here, 1 year there. I said, I have, you know, can you please, you know, I'm pregnant. I said, I don't have to promise you, but I've already promised God that I'll be, you know, I'm going to change my life. And so he did. He put me in a rehab for 6 months, but they only kept me for a month. And that was at the Salvation Army. And the only reason they kept me for a month is because I was pregnant. But they did put me in transitional housing. And from there on, I just started, like, you know, I worked for a guy that owned a cleaning company. And then after that, I started learning his ways, because I did everything for him. I hired, I fired, I did bids, I did sales, I did payroll. And I just decided I'm going to break off and do it on my own. And that's what I did. And God's hand's been on my whole business the entire time.
And what's the name of your business?
It's called Misty Sunshine Cleaning.
And you mentioned, how many people do you work for you?
Right now, 13.
What would you say to girls who've been through some similar things that you have, and, you know, you've come out the other end a successful businesswoman after all of these things that you've described? What advice do you have for them?
Don't give up. Believe in the higher power, that, you know, Jesus is real. You know, just because things bad have happened to you in the past does not mean you can't turn it around. Because look at me, you know, I wrote a book too, and by the grace of God, I'm a published author. You know, so great things come out of bad things. You know, God turns everything that's bad to your good.
Thank you so much, Misty. I really appreciate you sharing your story with us and with our listeners and other people who may be in similar situations. I think they'd appreciate it. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jessica Mazzaros talking with Misty Kinzel from Lee County, talking about her experiences right here in Southwest Florida up to 20 years ago. Jessica, how did you feel hearing Misty share that story?
I was really grateful to her for opening up so much as she did, because I think hearing these details of how one thing led to the other, for instance, being molested at 7 years old, feeling alone, home is not the place, a safe place for her. She goes out into the streets and meets people who, you know, say they can help her, and this is the way that you can survive on your own. You can, you know, you can become a prostitute, and then, and that way you could be independent.
I was just really grateful for her to, because I think our listeners hearing that story might say like, okay, that's how that happens. That's how you get into, you know, you can familiarize people with this is just one person's story of how they got there. And I think it's important for people to know.
That backstory is really critical.
The backstory.
To have some understanding.
Exactly.
People don't just wake up from a wonderful life and one day decide, oh, hey, I'm just going to go and change my life and do this. There's a cause and effect there. If you're just joining the show today, we're talking about human trafficking with victims who survived it and shared their stories with WGCU's Jessica Mazaros. You can join the conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So I'm wondering, Jessica, how common is her story?
It's very common. It's one of, from what I've heard in my reporting, one of the top three ways that a young person gets trafficked. I mean, the fact that she's vulnerable because she's on the streets and has nowhere to go, that's definitely a common thing in people who become trafficked. And then becoming addicted to drugs makes you extremely vulnerable because people who have access to those drugs can then manipulate you. And so I've heard that a lot before where, you know, you'll do anything for that drug. As Misty said, it became everything, you know, and that way, that's how other people can manipulate you and have power over you if you're on the streets and vulnerable, like being addicted to drugs. But also, there's a couple other ways. There's also now with social media, there's blackmail. There's maybe some young girls using Snapchat and take maybe kind of a sexy picture of themselves, and a potential trafficker could see that, screenshot it, and then threaten the young girl and say, I'm going to send this to your family. I'm going to, you know, your parents are not going to have jobs anymore. You're going to be a disgrace. So if you, you know, certain hours of the day come and work for me, you know, sex trafficking, then I won't tell your parents, and then your life won't be ruined and your parents' life won't be ruined. And so they'll go and they'll still come home at the end of the day sometimes, or and still be going to school. It's just a matter of they think they're so young and vulnerable. They think that the minors need to be doing this.
Like 13 or 14 years old.
Exactly.
And they're afraid, I'm going to bring down the ruin of my entire family.
Exactly.
Because I took this picture on social media, and then somebody's using it to blackmail.
Yep. And the other way is, I don't know if we've talked yet about Romeos, are these young men who basically, I think back then it used to be in malls. It might be now social media now. But these young cute boys come around to these teenagers or even 12-year-olds, minors, who are vulnerable, and they act like they're going to save them and that they make them fall in love with them. And then they start saying things like, hey, you know, if you want to stay together, start doing this for me. You know, so those are kind of the three ways. This usually has to do with drugs, blackmail, or Romeos, is what I found in talking to experts.
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, not a lot of people seem to even realize this is even happening. So what's going on to try and stop it?
Well, there are organizations and advocates that are trying to stop that. And for instance, Lynn Brewer, she's president of Southwest Florida Regional Human Trafficking Coalition. They work within five counties, Lee, Collier, Charlotte, Hendry, and Glades, to help victims of human trafficking. They help them find shelter, food, medical attention, and education, and sometimes legal services. Brewer says that back in the early 2000s, no one knew about human trafficking and assumed it was not separated from like the idea of prostitution. But trafficking is using someone against their will or who has been coerced rather than prostitution, where a woman could be independently working to sell his or herself. And Brewer says there are over 300,000 minors that go missing every year. She says that stats show a runaway child will be picked up for trafficking within 3 days. So here's my conversation with Lynn Brewer as she talks about a new trafficking program she's launching for teens.
We have started, with the help of an awesome young gentleman down in Naples, he has started our teen task force. And we will be having something that will go on our website and YouTube and any place we can put it, and it will be teens talking to teens. So, you know, our approach is how can you help keep your friends safe? Because you cannot go to minors and say, we want you to be safe, because they're invincible. We all were at that age. So it's, okay, how can you help your friend be safe? And that's going to be our campaign, to try to reach the children and trying to get parents to accept that their children need to know about human trafficking, just like they needed to learn about drugs, just like they needed to learn about sex education way back when. It's always a movement, and it always has pretty much the same cycle. So it's get your kids aware. Know what's around you.
So having worked on this issue and being an advocate and educator for so many years, where do you feel that this is going? I mean, I know it's hard to guess, but based on your, you know, what you know, where do you think this is going?
Well, nowhere good. The increase, and I think the knowledge of what is actually going on is just starting to surface. And it's already the second largest crime. So once this actually gets a hold and people realize it's out there, by that time, it's already going to be the number one crime in our country. How do you combat that? Knowledge, education, reaching as many people as you can. We would love to have a program with them, and we're working on a program with the airports. Let us put something in. Let us make you aware. And it's difficult because we are a tourist. We're a destination place. People in business make their money from the tours. So they don't really want tourists to think that our paradise is this hub of den of inequity, because it cuts into their profits. So we need to make these people understand that the more they know about it, the more they can actually safeguard their own business and actually make it a safe place as opposed to a non-safe place for people to come. And again, education, trying to get to people and changing their views on, oh, we don't want anybody in our lobby to talk about human trafficking, because we certainly wouldn't want our guests to hear about this, to, oh, yes, that sticker on the door is because all of our people have been trained on how to spot human trafficking, and we have a campaign against human trafficking. This is a safe house.
Those are some hopeful goals of where you'd like society, at least locally or nationally, to be?
Definitely. And it all starts with education. And just making sure that our young people are safe. And it seems that grandparents are really picking this up quicker than parents, which is very interesting. So, you know, if I can say anything to anyone, if you have the opportunity to learn good information, not just thrown together information, but true information about human trafficking and what you can do to help protect the people that you love and to watch out for people around you, is go to that seminar, go to that presentation, go get that information. Arm yourself on how not to.
Why do you do this? Why? I mean, you seem very busy. You have a lot going on, but this is something that you seem very invested in. You have been for some years. Why do you do this?
Well, okay, I've been asked that question many times. Someone has to be out there. Somebody has to start a movement. Someone has to get people to work together. And we have a wonderful team. And that is our objective, is to try to get all of these people to work together as a unit, including our neighborhoods and our communities, so that Southwest Florida is not number one. I mean, we have all the earmarks. We have the waterways. We have the highways. A child can be out of our state within an hour to 6 hours by one means or another. And no one watches, no one is observant of who is around them, because we all are kind of self-absorbed, which human beings naturally are. But I do this because many years ago, I actually was in the same room with a very young survivor, and the trauma and the look in their eye, the way they sat, broke my heart. That's why I'm here.
How did they sit?
Well, they're just very defensive. They don't know you. They know that their trafficker is either, you know, what their trafficker will do if they do something wrong. They know the consequences. They don't know you and I. So they're even more fearful of us. And normally there are drugs involved because that is a way that the traffickers control their human beings. So you have a lifeline there. They know what to expect, and that's where they get their drugs. You and I would sit in a room with one of them. They know nothing about us. They have no idea what we're going to do, and they're scared to death. The other situation, they're just traumatized to no end. So when someone looks at a toothbrush and says, it, in a backpack that we give them called a freedom pack, and they say, is this mine and how many other people do I have to share it with? That's, if that doesn't do something to your heart and your mind and your soul, then something is definitely wrong. You are just definitely not on this earth. So that's basically why I do it. I've just the look in their eyes, that would not be an end of the spectrum that I could ever, ever work with. It's the same reason I very seldom go to the dog pound or to the humane shelter because I'd have half of them in my home. I cannot do that. So all I can do is what I do well, which is helping to organize people, working with teams to find what our objective is and to reach that goal.
So do people reach out to you when they find they have a house that is filled with women that have been trafficked? And what is your role in what happens? Let's say they break into a house, they find these women that are trafficked, and then what do the police do? Then what happens?
They will normally call someone in our within our group, and our role is to basically hang back, number one. Okay, let this happen. It's to take the victims and be able to place them somewhere for a few days, shelter at least, until someone can evaluate them and actually decide where they go. Now, anyone under 18 automatically, you know, goes to the Children's Services without question, because we have nowhere, absolutely nowhere in our five counties where someone under 18 can go and have a safe environment. They can have the counseling, the medical treatment they need. They can have the educational portion that they have missed brought up to date. They can start building a new life. And that's one of the things that we are working on right now in our five counties is to have somewhere where these teens can be.
That was Lynn Brewer, the president of the Southwest Florida Regional Human Trafficking Coalition, talking with WGCU's Jessica Mazzaros, who's been working on this story for us. A lot of information there, but you can clearly hear the compassion that she feels for these people who've been victimized. And it's interesting, though, that she uses her strength and knows that being too close would be too heartbreaking for her to get anything done. It does take a certain kind of person to do that.
Yeah, and on the other end of that, I did speak with a couple who they work hands-on with these trafficked minors specifically. I interviewed them. They operate three homes for nine young women at a time who are trying to recover from trafficking. Sally and Lowell Senitz have operated Wings of Shelter since around 2007, and I've watched the trends in the types and numbers of victims and what kind of a toll it takes on minors. Let's hear my conversation with them. What is usually their demeanor when you meet these girls?
Well, I know that they have come to a point by the time they get to us, they might have been sheltered 20, 30 other times and eloped, had elopement history, a runaway history of that many times. And by the time they get to us, oftentimes they're very disillusioned, they're hopeless. I ask them what they want to do in the future, and they might tell me, oh, I just live for today. I only have enough for today. And so that's the sad part about it. Our real goal is to restore their self-identity, because they see themselves as complicit when truly their children have been coerced. So we want to rebuild their healthy identity, and we want to let them know that they're loved and that we are in total support of going forward in their life with them and engaging in rehabilitation. And also we provide, sometimes they'll go on a mission trip out of the country with church. Some, they always have private tutoring because the stress of public school overwhelms. They always come with a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder. And so they have to be in an environment where it's comfortable and safe and not overly pressured.
At what point is somebody like a graduate of your program? How do you know that when they're ready? And also,
How are they made to feel safe to walk around again based on their past?
Our girls are watched 24 hours, so we have caregivers go with them everywhere they go. And so that ups the statistics on their safety, as well as we take them from other areas of Florida, so they're not going to walk around town and run into a resource that they know. And so that gives them that extra safety net. And they go two paths. They either will return to a safe family member, if they should have one, at any point in time after they've been here about a year, or they will continue on with us until they turn 18 because they have no safe family member to return to. And at that point, DCF helps them in college waivers and helps them get an apartment. And we give help from Wings of Shelter as well for furniture, donations, things like that.
It is Human Trafficking Awareness Month, and I'm wondering, what are some things that people still don't know or still don't understand?
I would say the number one thing is that it actually is happening to American girls right here. The first three girls we got were Lee County residents living at home in single-parent families. Of course, they were left because the parents had to work on their own, and so they wandered the streets. But they were going to school. And that's a shock to most people. Everybody, if they think it's happening here, they think of kidnapping. And although that happens, it's a very small percentage. Now, a girl may disappear, but she's been coerced into it. The kind of thing where she gets kidnapped from a bus stop happens, but it's minimal.
What is the average age, if there is one, of the girls that you see coming in?
Between 11 and 17. And we see it going down lower now to 8 and 10 years of age.
What has it been like for you to be doing this for so many years and see it go down that low, that number?
I'm a mother and a grandmother, so it is heart-rending. It really is terrible. And I think part of it is that this particular area has not been well advertised or well taught and trained, and a lot of people in our society are really not aware of this. So what you're doing here, we just praise you for that, because making people aware is the first step to rescue and safety. And I think that I believe that the most heart-rending part for me is the girls become my hero because they fight through this trauma, they fight through the experiences that they've had, and they fight toward a new life. And we have many girls that have graduated, and they're doing beautiful things out there.
To see these girls keep coming into their shelter and getting younger and younger has got to be difficult for Sally and Lowell. But as I said, they turn out to become people who not only survive but eventually thrive. And that has to be reassuring.
So Sally and Lowell actually call the girls, rather than survivors, they like to call them overcomers because they overcome so much and they watch them overcome so much. And Wings of Shelter, they adhere to a strict policy of anonymity. I spoke with a graduate of their program, because they want to protect them. But I don't know her real name or where she is exactly. I just know she's from Florida and was trafficked starting at the age of 12 when she was alone on the streets. She's now a medical assistant for a pediatrician somewhere out of the state. And here's my conversation with the young woman that they call Angel. So how did you first meet Sally and Lowell?
I met Sally and Lowell back when I was 15. I was recovered by the FBI in New Orleans and was unable to return home. So they had brought me back to Florida and had placed me in their group home, Wings of Shelter. Well, safe house.
And do you mind if I ask what events led you to entering a Wings of Shelter safe house?
Since the age of 12, I was being, solicited. I was being trafficked by a guy who, back when I was younger, I thought was my man, my boyfriend, the person who takes care of me and protects me and watches over me. After dating him for a few months, he, told me what his real, ideas of our relationship was. And basically, he was the one who took care of me. I didn't have my parents to live with, so I stayed with him, and he had got me started into prostitution as a way to stay in a relationship with him, Like, it was more like, if you do this for me, you love me, and I did it because I had nowhere to go, and that's all I had. So
you met him when you were 12, you said?
Yeah, I met him when I was 12. I met him at a gas station. I was homeless at the time. I was a runaway, and then I got kicked out, and it was just on and off situations of me just kind of just wandering around in the streets.
And how did you end that relationship?
It ended once I had gotten recovered in New Orleans after getting caught for my third time. Well, my second in New Orleans, but like my fifth arrest in Florida for prostitution. I just got rescued, and I've never spoken to him since.
Were there other girls with you involved, or was it just a you and him relationship where he got you wrapped up in that?
At first, it was just me and him, I guess you could say, during the training process. I kind of learned what I was supposed to do, what I was supposed to say, and get comfortable with what I was doing. And then it came to a point where he brought other women around me and was like, this is the situation, and this is going to happen. You can stay or you can go. And I mean, I had nothing else to do and nowhere else to go, so I kind of just dealt with the situation and just played my role.
And for other girls hearing this who may be in a similar situation as you were, what advice do you have to help them avoid the same event happening to them?
I guess instead of running to think that you can do it on your own, look for somebody. There's always someone. Like me personally, I felt like I didn't have anyone to run to. I feel like if I would have had someone I could tell this is my situation, I would have an alternative route. And just to open your eyes and be careful. Like, love is blind. And, you know, sometimes as young girls, we get wrapped up in it and we do things that we wind up regretting in the future, things that me personally could have ended my life. So, I mean, just be careful. Don't feel like you're alone. And just, you know, reach out to somebody before it's too late.
And those other girls that he brought in, were they in a similar situation as you, a similar background where they had nowhere else to go? Or?
Well, we were actually all different, and that is what I realized. I mean, we had, you know, a girl who had a baby, and, you know, the baby stayed in the hotel room with us, and, you know, she trafficked to take care of her and her kid. We had, you know, a woman that was on drugs, and he sold drugs, so he supplied her needs. I mean, it's all different. Different stories, but similar atmospheres. We all were just someone looking for someone to help us with our needs.
So what was the Wings of Shelter program like for you? You said you were 15?
Yes. It was a big change of lifestyle for me. I mean, I grew up in, like, shelters and stuff. So I came to it. It was a nice, beautiful house. It was kind of, like, too good to be true. It took a lot of time to adapt to being in an environment where, you know, it's different. Like, the location is, you know, good. I'm used to being where people get shot and hurt, and there's, you know, people outside looking for drugs. Like, it was a nice atmosphere. The house is nice. It was just a change. It was a huge change. It was like peace. It was a peaceful atmosphere that, you know, I wasn't used to at first. It was like being at a resort and a getaway somewhere.
Can you describe your life now?
Right now, I am a medical assistant at a pediatric office, and I am a sitter at a local church for our nursery.
Did you ever think that this is where you'd be now?
No. I didn't even think I'd even make it to be 23, to be honest. Or I thought I'd be, like, in the adult entertainment industry or something. Like, those were my options.
Do you ever talk to people about what happened in your past, or do you just move on with it every day?
The only people I've ever really talked to my past about is basically, like, people, like, you know, if I'm going to try to help someone or if I know someone in my situation. But as far as me, like, bringing it up, like, as a subject or a conversation, it's kind of a door I've closed. I've talked about it. I've helped other people through it, and I've moved on. So it's kind of forgotten. Like, anyone I meet in the future, they don't know that. They know who I am now, not who I was.
As a person, how would you describe yourself now compared to how you were before at 12 years old and vulnerable?
I mean, I would describe myself as a survivor now. I used to be weak. You know, I used to be manipulated easily. Like, I had no, like, self-confidence. Like, I feel like I can take over the world now. Like, I don't feel like there's anything in this world I can't get over. Like, I've been through the worst, so it's, like, up from there.
Great. And my last question is, what are your hopes for your future?
Well, right now I'm trying to go back into college and one day open up a daycare. I'm really into kids and just being able to, you know, sit here and be a part of their growth in life and maybe be one of those people who can say, you know, like, you can come to me if you need me. So.
Well, Angel, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
So, Jessica, she mentioned in there that she was arrested for prostitution, and according to how she's telling it, it sounds like she was around 14 years old, and I guess that was in New Orleans. But I'm wondering, how does Florida law treat young people, people that are minors, as far as being charged with prostitution?
Well, in 2016, Governor Rick Scott signed a measure into law protecting minors from being labeled and charged as prostitutes in the state. And law also requires that the convicted traffickers be registered as sexual predators.
Is there any other legislative action in this session that's wanting to crack down even more on sex trafficking in Florida?
Yes. Proposed legislation in Tallahassee right now aims to bring greater awareness to human trafficking in the state. Bills filed in the Florida House and Senate would create a permanent human trafficking hotline statewide and require the state to develop campaigns to increase public awareness about the issue, particularly among youth and other vulnerable populations. State Senate bill sponsor Perry Thurston calls trafficking modern-day slavery.
A trafficker with an average of 4 to 6 victims can make up to $150,000 to $200,000 per person per year. Unfortunately, too many of these victims largely go unnoticed.
Thurston says there were nearly 1,900 reports of human trafficking in Florida in 2016. That's a 54% increase from the previous year. But so far, neither bill has been heard by any legislative committee.
And before we run out of time, I want to ask you, if someone suspects this, how are they supposed to report it? Do they call the police? How do they go about reporting it correctly?
So there's a national hotline. It's 1-888-373-7888. You can also call the U.S. Department of Justice, or there's a Florida abuse hotline, 1-800-96-ABUSE, or you can just simply call 911.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for all the reporting that you did on this really important topic, on this, the last day of Sex Trafficking Awareness Month. It's a conversation that needs to continue well beyond the month, as you have discovered some shocking statistics
thank
and
you.
Stories.
Thank you so much for allowing me the full hour to be able to talk about this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we really need it. And if you missed any parts of today's show or you'd like to share it with other people to spread the word, you can find it at gulfcoastlive.org. Our show today was produced by Jessica Mazaros, and yours truly, our director, is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator today is Rachel Iacovone. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.